Welcome everyone, this is our first Leadership Forum of the year. I'm Louise Campbell, I'm the convener of the Leadership and Career Development Committee. I'm really pleased to see everyone here today, and you must all be wanting to invest some time in developing your own leadership skills and think about your career. And that it really is the main objective of our Leadership and Career Development Committee. So we do that by having these free leadership forums and a number of other events that you might see during the year. So welcome again. I've got Martin Mulcair here who's going to facilitate the Q&A and introduce Leslie Traverso for us. Martin is a former member of the Leadership and Career Development Committee as well, so it's great to have him here helping us out today. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise. Before I introduce our special guest speaker, I'd like to make a special welcome to the people on the webinar. And you are most welcome to submit comments and questions. In fact, there is a contest with the events team as to how many questions we'll get from the webinar people today. We'll also be looking for questions from the audience, of course, when the time comes. So let's talk about when the time comes. We're going to have about 25 minutes from our guest speaker. That'll leave us about 45 minutes for a reasonably wide-ranging discussion. We're aiming to wrap up, therefore, at about 1:45, so people that need to be back in the office by 2 can get there. At the same time, anybody that saw the 2 o'clock wrap-up seriously, we'd love to have people stay for an informal conversation after that. So that's the broad plan. 25 minutes from our guest speaker, about 45 minutes discussion, and then time for an informal chat or disappear, as the case may be. I'll explain the logistics about questions when the time comes. Our very special guest today is Leslie Traverso. Leslie started her career in actuarial recruitment in London in 1993, obviously still at school at that time. Leslie moved to Australia in 2000, and during that time, she has had literally thousands of conversations with actuaries all around the world, both as candidates and as clients. She's seen people move from student to senior leader in their organisation. So today, she'd like to share some thoughts and some observations around the themes of leadership and especially diversity. Now, this isn't just leadership of others, but also how you can lead yourself to have a more diverse career. Please welcome Leslie Traverso.
Thank you, Martin. And after 24 years, I need glasses. So, good afternoon, everybody. In my talk today, I'd like to explore three themes around diversity and leadership that are all underpinned by the need for us to have conversations around these issues. My perspective on leadership and diversity, how you can create a more diverse career, and how you can take the lead to ensure that your organisation enables career paths that attract a wide spectrum of people. First of all, a leadership perspective. Good leadership is not just the preserve of those with high-level job titles and lots of reports. It is a many-faceted trait that encompasses leadership of oneself, thought leadership within a profession, as well as the wise leadership of others. Leadership is a lot about inspiration, inspiring others by the decisions that we make and the way that we react to others' decisions, inspiring others to achieve their best by giving them respect and space, so that they in turn can inspire others. That makes for a better world. It is, to paraphrase Einstein, striving to be of value. There are a lot of ways to inspire others. We often think that inspirational leadership comes only from those who strut around on a stage and are loud in their way of dealing with people. Sure, many inspirational leaders do have a strong personal presence and are fine orators, think Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. But not all. People who gain respect of and are able to inspire others often go about their lives quietly living their values. They are authentic, they have the utmost consideration for others, and are constantly looking for ways to help others to achieve. They are not afraid to have those courageous conversations that really make a difference. As an example, I have a good friend who was recently treated very poorly by the organisation that she had given 30 years of commitment and loyalty to. A job restructure was badly communicated, giving her the impression she was no longer valued. During 2 weeks of feeling exceptionally hurt by the situation, when a lot of people would have become resentful, she didn't. She quietly maintained her dignity and made sure that each and every one of her team were given what they needed to continue to excel in their roles. When she was ready, she instigated open conversations with her senior leaders. She asked them why, how was this decision made, what is it all about? She also met with the more senior person who had delivered that message to her, with the prime motivation actually of coaching that person not to repeat the action the same way again. In her words, I don't want anyone else in this organisation to feel that the way that I do right now because of someone's inability to deliver a message to a member of staff appropriately. That's leading oneself and striving to lead others. But who has the right stuff to lead? Are leadership traits inborn or developed? According to the businessman Jack Welch, the three key baseline traits for any good leader for which there are no compromise are integrity, intelligence and emotional maturity. The first two are key hallmarks of the actuarial profession. The third is more individual. The other essential traits he cited were positive energy, an upbeat attitude, the ability to energise others, having an edge, which is the ability to make tough calls, the ability to get things done, and passion. Some of these are inbuilt and form part of personality. But having an edge and being able to execute effectively are only gained by experience, by the development of professional confidence that comes with time at the coalface. The described traits are within people from all backgrounds. It's not the colour of their skin or their body shape or who they are romantically attracted to that determines whether they have integrity, whether they have an upbeat attitude or they can execute a strategy. However, when you look at the composition of many senior management teams in insurance companies, the leaders of the ASX 500, universities, parliament and government bodies, you may think that to be a good leader, you also need to be Anglo-European and male. On average, the traits I've described are more prominent in some cultures than others. If you look at the team leadership mix versus the team member mix in your organisation, you'll probably see this play out. However, diversity in an organisation is not a nice to have. It is a vital part of the development of a successful business and contributes towards an inclusive society. It is good leadership that drives diversity and poor leadership that stymies it. Diversity is also not just a male versus female representation issue. It's the colours of our communities, the disabilities and LGBTI. Let's consider professional diversity from two perspectives now, each the side of the same coin. One, the actuary who seeks to broaden their career into new industries or new fields of work, the candidate perspective, to put it into recruitment speak, and the executive who can influence who joins that organisation, i.e. the client perspective. Both sides of this equation are hindered by groupthink and unconscious bias. The actuary who wants to do something different may be risk-averse, not sure how to go about making a change, not sure how to market themselves effectively, perhaps wary of new technology. The hiring company often plays it safe and recruits a candidate who has done the job before and looks and sounds like one of their own. But I do think this is changing, and it certainly needs to. Thinking now about creating your own diverse career path. Organisations are constantly looking at the threats and opportunities that new technologies provide them. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, advanced data analytics, all these will have a profound effect on the future and shape of actuarial careers, which will lead to a greater emphasis on the ability to think creatively, to be a strategic leader, and less on crunching numbers. To move into a new field, into a new role that you haven't done before, but feel passionate about, or to ensure that you get the promotion that you deserve, you need to find the organisation and the hiring managers that truly champion diversity and inclusion, and not ones that just pay lip service to it. And I'm thinking professional diversity here. To share an example, back in 2003, I interviewed a young statistician working for an insurance software business. He was passionate about what data could do. He saw a future where organisations would be able to use data much more effectively and in greater quantities to make strategic decisions. That was back in 2003. Some of the organisations that he was interviewed by could see that he was switched on and bright, but wasn't really, to quote, a fit for the role they were looking to fill. Along came Deloitte and saw his potential. They loved how he thought and how forward-thinking he was. They employed him, not really knowing exactly what he would be doing, just they knew he would do it well. He subsequently was very successful, and he also went on to create two or three startup data analytics businesses, and is now an industry leader who consults and trains others in the big data space. You can see that this person had a vision, a determination, and a passion for what he wanted to do. And the hiring company was willing to look at someone outside the box, someone brimming with ideas and enthusiasm, but no specific experience. I have seen actuaries from superannuation firms move into general insurance. I've seen actuaries from overseas successfully transition into the Australian market. I've seen actuaries become investment managers, underwriting managers, software coders, general managers, kindergarten owners, property gurus, paramedics, many more. The actuarial skill set provides all these opportunities. What it is less good at, often, is marketing itself. Actuaries are known for their thought leadership, being able to assess facts and make pragmatic commercial decisions. Why not translate this process into your career and hiring decisions? If you're looking to change direction, consider all the aspects of your skills that set you apart from the competitors for that position. Market yourself on the basis of how you're going to solve that employer's business problem. How can you give her the outcome she's looking for better than someone with a more obvious background? It may be that you will need a few steps in between to achieve that goal. You may listen or read other people's stories and wonder, how can I get there? Firstly, make sure that you have clarity in your mind as to what the ultimate objective is. Be sure it's what you really want. Consider all the angles, positive and negative. For example, you are likely to have to take a pay cut. How does that sit with your family? What do you need to cover your outgoings? Look at adverts for this type of role. Study what the requirements are and start to think about what you already have, what you need to learn, and how you're going to articulate, this is me, to someone effectively. Maybe find someone already doing the role that you want. Go and buy them a coffee or a lunch. Find out what it's really like to do that job. What's the reality rather than the advertisement? Start to have those conversations. You also need to put yourself out there so people know you are open to a change of direction or want to learn a new role. This is where making sure you're having conversations is vital. As a recruiter, I've found over the years it's often the one-off unexpected conversation at a function or on the phone that's led to a placement. You can do this for yourself too. Attend industry functions, just to have conversations, find out about other people, let other people find out about you. Ultimately, people will always hire people and not resumes. Creating your own business is another avenue, of course. There's an actuary I spoke to just yesterday who since 2008 has been applying her pricing knowledge to predicting house prices and using analytics as a tool to persuade developers to sell at a discount. Her advice, marry your skill set to your passions. Let's look at the hiring company angle for a moment and how we can encourage diversity there. Many companies are working hard to promote diversity and inclusion in the workforce. They have a realistic budget and sponsor initiatives around training, affinity groups, scorecards, etc. However, when I talk to hiring managers, to candidates, and read articles in the media, like the one in the Harvard Business Review a couple of weeks ago entitled, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? And many others that have been published more recently, Julie Lessing's work comes to mind about the pay gap, I wonder about the true efficacy of these methods. In recent research, KPMG in the UK noted that whilst men would apply for a role if they had 80% of the required skills, women think that they are missing 20% and don't bother. They also found that if a guy has a job offer from a competitor and is counter-offered by his employer, he is more likely to receive a financial bonus to prevent him from leaving, which itself contributes to the gender pay gap. So thinking for a moment on the gender imbalance question at senior level in most organisations, what's a fairer way to make hiring and promotional decisions? We're all aware of unconscious bias and try our best not to be swayed. But by its very nature, that is a difficult, if not impossible, task. In fact, there are examples of corporate training now that has stopped trying to eliminate biases, but works on enhancing awareness of the negative consequences of those biases and how to overcome them. Think for yourselves for a moment of some scenarios when you've been at receiving end of somebody else's assumptions. I'll share an example. When I was in my early 20s, in the dark ages, I used to ride a motorbike. I was moving into a house and I needed to buy a fridge, so I went along to have a look at the local electrical retailer. I popped into my store in the lunch hour in my work clothes, smart suit, high heels, that's when I used to wear them, the works. A very polite shop assistant showed me some different models and we had a good chat. I said I would return on Saturday when I had a little bit more time to sort out an order. I returned that Saturday wearing jeans, a leather jacket and carrying a crash helmet. The welcome I got from the store was somewhat different. This time I got virtually ignored and was then asked in a very condescending way, "Well, I suppose you'll be wanting credit." The actuarial workplace should be a good place to champion diversity. It should allow flexibility of hours. It should allow career breaks. It should consider people for the way that they think, not what they have done. Taking gender imbalance as an example, as soon as you get to a certain level, you are assessed for commitment, a strong character, the ability to push back. All traits that traditionally could be perceived as being inconsistent with being female, a view, as we all know, is clearly misplaced. Presenteeism is still a big thing in many organisations. Companies should think about whether the person actually needs to be in the office 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, or if the right person could create their own flexible work week. For that, you need to focus on designing measurable outputs, not inputs. It also takes an effective leader to ensure that corporate objectives can be met with a team that works flexibly. A few years ago, I ran a business that involved having people report to me in Europe, the UK, and Asia. Being a leader of teams spread around the world with major time difference is a good lesson in managing remotely and waking up very early. The reason why it was successful was because I chose people very carefully. I trusted them implicitly, and we had very clear objectives and outcomes for each week. Sometimes hiring managers think they are championing diversity, but the reality is somewhat different. I had a situation just a few months ago with one of the Big Four banks. When after I had a long conversation about diversity and inclusion with the manager, and he articulated he's very happy for people to work flexibly as long as they achieve their KPIs, he proceeded to reject the perfect candidate because she couldn't be in the office every day. There was another example of a talented senior actuary working in London who transitioned from male to female while she was working for an actuarial consulting practice. Her direct employer was very supportive, but when she sought to change roles, many interviewers were more concerned about what their clients would think rather than the value she would bring to the organisation. Fortunately, there are a lot of organisations that are serious about diversity and inclusion. I picked up in the news the other day, Zurich was recently awarded the EDGE certification, which is a global business certification standard for gender equality. Deloitte recently had an Aspiring Women's program, which was very well received, except only 5% were from an Asian background. There's a little way to go yet on cultural diversity. On a practical level, what steps can be taken as individuals to encourage all facets of diversity? One way of overcoming unconscious bias is to implement mechanisms or processes that neutralise biases in the recruitment and promotion process. Think first about how your firm goes about attracting talent. A recent PwC survey revealed that the barriers employers and candidates identified as preventing the hiring of women included lack of a sufficient candidate pool, industry sector not being viewed as attractive by women, lack of adequate skills experience, women not pursuing career opportunities as aggressively as men, and systemic challenges within employer attraction and selection processes. Ask yourself, what skills are lacking in your team currently? What business issue is the person's appointment going to solve? Is it a role focused on saving the organisation money or focus on developing a new suite of products to create more revenue? There are unfortunately still people around who want to see a bum on a seat rather than find a solution to a business issue. Are your advertisements weighted towards attracting one type of person? Are they focused on what outcomes you need the person to achieve, or are they just a list of tasks? Put yourself in the shoes of the candidate. Have a look at the wording of advertisements for job titles that you think you might like. What images do the word competitive and drive conjure up? If you're involved in writing an ad or a job description, choose the words carefully to encourage applicants from a broad range of candidates. Now look at jobs that you would like to do. If you had 70 or 80% of what was required, would you apply? Many people wouldn't. In reality, it's rare that an employer expects to get someone who can do everything they ask for. If they could, where would be the growth and development? Over the years, I've placed people into jobs on a feeling or a hunch that they would be the right fit by focusing on the business issue that needs solving, how the person can add specific value to the role, and asking the question, why can't this person do this, rather than focusing on this person doesn't have the right experience. Where does the candidate's resume go to when it arrives in your organisation? If it's through a portal, who is reading it at the other end? Are they looking for someone who has done the same job before, or are they looking for potential? Are they looking for a mindset, an attitude, an approach, commitment, evidence of transferable skill sets? Why do a lot of people insist on recruiting someone to do the same job they've been doing for the past few years? Why not recruit someone for the potential of what they could become in the future? As an idea, why not use a brief online test prior to a face-to-face interview? I have clients who focus entirely on the person's way of thinking and their creativity and set quite abstract questions as a first test to assess their problem-solving ability. Why not send something like that to everyone that applies automatically? If a candidate demonstrates great thinking skills but maybe lacks the years of experience required for that opening, see them anyway. There might be opportunities in the future for them. And doing me out of a fee. What about the actual interview? There's a famous story of an orchestra that carried out blind auditions, which resulted in a sharp increase in the number of female leads recruited. We can't do that most of the time, but what we can do is to use techniques that don't put a disproportionate percentage of the decision on how well someone can big themselves up at interview. Who carries out the interviews? Make sure your interview panel is diverse itself. Use questions about how that find out really how a person thinks, not regurgitates what's on the resume. I encourage clients to use a case study or inbox exercise as a true differentiator between candidates. Then you can see how they approach problems, how they're able to describe how they reach the answer, how their style would fit your organisation, rather than what they can say they can do. My experience of that method has been incredibly revealing. Often the slick interviewee can't actually deliver, and the person who is left less comfortable with selling themselves has shone through. You might be asking yourself at this point, what about using some funky technology in the recruitment assessment process? Wouldn't that cut out bias? Yes, it is possible to create objective fit analysis tools that help identify the best qualified candidate for open position. It assesses and weights a variety of factors and matches against the requirements for success in that position. A shortlist is then interviewed. However, for once, a data-driven solution might not be the reliable one. A recent article in the Financial Times reported that scientists had found evidence that data-driven recruitment algorithms have the potential to learn our prejudices. The filters detect patterns of underrepresentation and reproduce them, perpetuating biases against already disadvantaged groups. In summary, about leadership, it's not all about being the next Nelson Mandela. Leaders are often quiet achievers. Find someone in your organisation you admire for their leadership, observe them in action. Ask if you can talk to them about what leadership means to them and what they have learnt on the way to becoming where they are now. Your career. If you have passion for something and know that your actuarial training would be a perfect fit for a particular role, why not approach the organisation, preferably the hiring manager, with a well thought through and prepared presentation on what value you can bring. Your own recruiting. If you're responsible for hiring or contribute to the composition of your team, why not be the one who keeps asking, why can't we have someone like? Why wouldn't this person be a good fit? Why can't this role be run from home 2 days a week? Be the one who encourages female and other colleagues to apply for promotions. The real glue that binds the three threads together today is to encourage you to start having more conversations. Have the courage to seek out someone new to talk to that could give you that insight into leadership that you seek, or could provide you with a connection into that company that you would like to work for. All too often we feel, oh, I wouldn't want to bother him or her. Why would they want to talk to me? Most of the time, they don't think like that at all, and we're delighted to have the opportunity to share information with you. To paraphrase an old Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Now, it covered a wide range of territory there, and we would welcome questions, comments on all three of the areas. If you'd like to hear more about Leslie's observations on leadership broadly, if you'd like to ask some questions about diversifying your career, or if you've got some comments, observations, questions about diversifying your workplace, here is your opportunity. We also have this being recorded as well as on the webinar, so we will be asking you to use a microphone. And as I mentioned earlier, people on the webinar, I'm assured that your questions, once typed, will be delivered to me, and I'm sure because they're typed, I'll be able to read them. Who'd like to start? And please mention your name as well for the purpose of the recording.
Hi, my name is Amy Titus. I'm from Insurance House. My question was, how do we challenge groupthink within an organisation where we don't have the capacity to hire outside and where the existing organisation lacks the diversity?
Are you thinking in the context of an internal promotion?
No, I'm just thinking in the context of solutions and what strategies challenging like these. I come from a very white workplace and a very like established old white man's industry. Given that that is the like nature of our industry, and how do we get out of thinking in the traditional method when we don't have the capacity to hire currently?
Yeah, I think it comes down to having those conversations around why don't we do something different when the scenario comes up that they are looking to hire. Is making sure, I think one of the things I referred to is making sure the adverts keep it very open to a wide number of people to apply, because often it's that people are sort of put off by some of those wordings. And then if you're not getting the people to apply, you can't therefore have some start creating diversity in the workplace without those people sort of coming through. So it's making sure that they're broader, and making sure that when resumes come in is having a look and doing the why not question rather than the, oh, this person isn't quite fit what we're looking for. The blind audition one is quite a good one. And like I say, you can't do that per se, but you can do that by, if it was a technical role, for example, doing a test, first of all, to look at the way that they're thinking without knowing anything more sort of about them, and then that will start to encourage. And once you start to encourage people to apply, people to come in, look at broadening out who you're asking to come into the organisation, or even deliberately going out to look for people from different backgrounds to create that diversity into the organisation as well.
Thanks, Amy.
Hi, Alex Gould from Alliance. And just on, I think this is a similar kind of question, because maybe the answer to your question is that it takes time in response. And so I've got a time-based question, and we're all actuaries, or a lot of us are, so we love cohorts. So the question is, you're talking about the senior boards being, you know, the grey, white-haired men. How much do you think, in the absence of action in the flexibility space, diversity space, if we waited long enough, would we see the composition of the boards change naturally?
I did read something about that exact point a couple of weeks ago, and I think the quote was 157 years. so it isn't going to happen without action, and it's got to be. And then there's pros and cons for the looking at the quotas as being an answer to that. And there was something else I was reading the other day about if you have a quota, where does that leave the rest of the board, and how does that actually work in reality, and are you getting the right people? Because at the end of the day, it's getting the right person, irrespective, but you have to start championing, because unless women and other minority groups start to move up, they're never going to get to board level, get the experience to be able to get there. If you're internally on a panel, for example, and you're assessing people for promotion, and it's all the stereotype, it's making sure there are people that are applying for those roles internally and pushing them up and getting the experience.
Thanks, Alex. Next.
Michelle Menenberg from TEL. You mentioned in interviews exploring about how people think as opposed to the experience. So what are some of the types of questions you'd be asking to explore the thinking?
I think it depends on the role that you're looking to recruit for, but the way of thinking might be giving somebody like an inbox exercise or an exercise around a piece of work that you do. When I was at Quantium, we used to have some data and ask somebody to talk through how they would approach finding something in that data that was interesting. There was one, without giving away any secrets, there was one that was to do with the United Nations and how many people sat at different times of the year and that sort of thing, and to find out that there was one time when the sitting rates were different because it was the Christmas holidays, and seeing if somebody could sort of find that piece of information. So it's things like that, is finding out how they approach a problem. So think about what you need for the role that you are recruiting for, and work out a way of finding out their creativity. So that would be one example. Some organisations do quite abstract ones, like how many golf balls are sold on a Saturday morning in Sydney. Again, it doesn't really matter what the answer is. What you're looking for there is how would somebody go about finding out the answer to that particular problem. So it's the problem solving, the creativity, just a way of approaching things. Because often, I've seen people interview, and often the interviewer will sit there with a resume and say, oh yes, I see you've done some personal lines pricing. Great, tick. Move on. Oh, you did a little bit of commercial. What did you do? How did you do it? Describe. I mean, the old, we all know in terms of competency-based questions, but it's really digging into those and thinking about beforehand as how you get out the answer that you're wanting to get out. You know, what was their involvement in that particular piece of work? What were the problems that they came up against before? How did they go about solving them? What would they have done differently now if they look back and reflect on that particular project? Yeah, thank you.
Next question. Louise, you can use my microphone.
Leslie, do you think employers are doing enough to help people in developing their careers, or where should the balance be between being driven by the employee and assisted by the employer?
I see frequently people who come to me and I say, oh, why do you want to leave your current role? Oh, my employer's not listening to me. I'm not getting the development I want. I'm not being pushed. So no, there's not enough that goes on. And depending on the organisation, I think as well, is that because actuaries learn quickly, want to keep learning, the organisation can't necessarily keep up with that progress. So I think there needs to be a lot more work done on the career development, which I think will feed into the earlier point there about how do we get more diverse boards, where you've got to start pushing people up through it by developing careers more quickly through the career cycle. So there's not enough done at the moment, no.
Next question. I got one more while you're thinking. The 80% scenario struck me. If I was a candidate and I'm applying a role where I've got about 80% of the skills stroke experience required, but I'm dealing with an old-fashioned interviewer who's worried about the 20% that's missing, not the 80% I've got, how would I deal with that in the interview?
I think you could deal with that by asking the person what business problem they're trying to solve with this hire.
Mm-hmm.
So they may, I'm trying to think of an example, we need somebody to do all this bit, okay, well, out of all those lists of tasks, what percentage of my time would be taken up doing all these lists of tasks? Mm-hmm. And it may very well be that the 20% that's missing actually only gets done once every 3 months and you can learn it. And then it's differentiating between the bits that somebody can learn and then the bits that you need to have to know how to do already.
Okay, and some that you could probably do in advance of the interview as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so change roles. Let's say I'm the old-fashioned interviewer and I've got a bit of an obsession about the 20% that's missing. What's your advice to me that I let go of that obsession in the course of the interview?
Yeah, I think similar advice would be to think about what the person is going to actually do. What is the output? Not can that person tick all these boxes? Is what are they actually going to produce for the company? What do they need to do to be able to save the company money or to create money for the company or whatever the issue happens to be?
Mm-hmm.
And think about it sort of more broadly. I've known lots of people who have got sort of jobs at the end of the day where you think, gosh, that's strange, but I can see now the logic behind that.
Okay, thank you. Now, first question from the webinar audience. This is from Trang Duncanson. Thank you, Trang. Leslie, you mentioned the KPMG global work around 80-20 regarding male versus female confidence when applying for a role. And in your recruitment interview experience across the globe, have you observed differences in traits, that is confidence coming through, stepping up behaviours, other leadership traits that you talked about, from these dimensions, firstly, in terms of gender and secondly, cultural, that could impact their success in getting the role relative to others? That's a long question. You want me to take through it again?
That's okay.
Okay, you good?
So looking at the two elements, I think, that Trang was asking for. One was what's the difference in the different genders when applying for roles that perhaps they don't have all the experience for, and the other was different people from different backgrounds, what's the difference in traits that come through there. So looking at the gender question first, I've definitely noticed a massive difference between some guys who say, yeah, I can do that, yeah, I can do that, yeah, I can do that, and you know that perhaps they can't, and once you start probing through the questions, you sort of find out that perhaps that isn't the complete experience that they've had. Whereas with women, it's very much about almost as a female, you need to almost prove yourself to be better than a guy, or think that you have to prove yourself to be better than a guy to get the role that you want, particularly as you get more senior in the organisation. And so therefore, women often lose a little bit of confidence from that and will hold themselves back or will not apply because of that sort of feeling, which is actually sort of not true, of course. On the cultural backgrounds or different countries around the world, certainly there are some of those traits that are highlighted that are stronger in some cultures than there are in others. And I think often there are some cultures that are naturally a little bit more reticent to push forward. And then I would say it depends on the culture in which you are working compared to the culture from which you come from, to make sure that you learn how to adopt some of the cultures of the culture that you live in to enable you to compete in that particular workforce.
Okay. Thank you, Tang. If you'd like to have a follow-up, if that didn't cover all of that, then please feel free. Next question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Peter McAllister from XL Cattle. You talked about candidates having diversity of experience across different industries and stuff, which seems beneficial to employers and the candidate themselves. Can you suggest why it's perhaps not more prevalent for companies in different industries to partner and facilitate, you know, secondments or exchange of employees across industries to get that diversity of experience, but where the candidates are in a more supportive environment rather than having to go out on a limb and take a new job somewhere to try and get that experience? And if it's not that prevalent, you know, what are those pitfalls that employers might be reluctant to do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fantastic idea. To be able to have a lot more sort of cross-fertilisation of ideas and experience. In the UK years ago, a lot of the big insurance companies used to do like cadetship type of programmes where you would join as a graduate and you'd move around to all the departments. These may have been sort of multi-line, so you'd be able to do life and GI and pensions and whatever and do everything in a very supportive environment, and that was great. That doesn't happen so much in Australia, but I think the opportunity for people to experience different areas with a comfort of being an employer would be a great one to be able to make happen. I think it can happen sometimes with the consulting practices who put people onto secondment in different areas. That's often a good way to be able to do that. But that comes about by virtue of a business need of the consultancy's client, rather than from a person's point of saying, oh, I'd really like to go and do that sort of thing. So I think it's a good idea, and I think it's something that, as the actuarial profession changes, I think over the next few years we're going to see a lot of changes because of different changes in technology, etc. Then to look at different ways of different firms cooperating will be good.
Is it sufficient, Peter? Okay. I wasn't sure that was covered your secondment across industries as well as internal secondments. That'd be good. Thank you. Next question. Leslie, perhaps to spark some conversation, we had a discussion ahead of time about a particular activity that Leslie had in mind and whether to include it in her talk. Or to leave it for discussion. And we thought, no, let's leave it for discussion, especially if it goes a bit quiet, we might run a little activity. And this will apply to the people on the webinar as well, if you've got pen and paper or thinking time. But what we'd like to have is people just look somebody sitting near you in perhaps pairs, or if it's not practical, threes, but yeah, two or three. And we want to go back to this question of assumptions. Remember Leslie giving the example about her turning up in her business attire and being treated like a highly valued customer when it was lunchtime. But when she came back on Saturday with her jeans, leathers and her motorbike helmet, she got a very different reception. You remember that story? So we think that everybody probably has had an experience where someone has made assumptions about you. So it might be instructive to A, think about the last time that someone made an incorrect assumption about you, think about how you felt, and compare notes with the person around you. So people on the webinar, your extra challenge, because you won't have anybody to talk to, will be not only think about the last time somebody made an assumption about you, how you felt, but also think about the last time you made an incorrect assumption about somebody else. We won't do the hard part here because you can talk instead. Okay, so you've got 30 seconds thinking time. When was the last time somebody made an incorrect assumption about you? It doesn't have to be in the workplace. You heard Lizzie's example was in the refrigerator shop. So in the workplace or outside the workplace, 30 seconds thinking time. When did someone make an incorrect assumption?
Thank you.
Okay, that's your 30 seconds. Now time to find someone. Anybody sitting in a corner by themselves, you have to find someone to talk to. All right, quick exchange. Tell them about the scenario and how you felt.
I'd just be really surprised that see someone like you. And I reckon he's going to be one of those ones that is it something about her podcast because her husband or husband's friends that's all actually not interested in that.
If the other person hasn't had a turn yet, give them the other person a turn. Seconds. Okay, Leslie's keen to hear a few examples. So people on the webinar, if you'd like to share, especially because you didn't get to talk to somebody necessarily, if you'd like to type in your example, we would love to read about your example of assumptions being made about you. I was sharing mine with Leslie, and this isn't a big deal, but I can remember not long after I had been overseas on a backpacking tour and got a little bit of culture, coming back, and I went to an exhibition at the art gallery. And I ran into a woman who was married to an actuary friend of mine. And she said, "What are you doing here?" And with a straight face. And I said, "Oh, I thought it'd be interesting." "Oh, gee, I'm surprised that you'd be interested in the art exhibition." And so how do I feel? I felt like it was kind of like this being typecast. I didn't know there was a comment on her husband or her husband's friends. But it seemed to me quite unreasonable to draw a line. Actuary does not equal art gallery. That was my example. What's an example you heard? Listening, what's one you heard that you thought, wow, that was a good example of an unfair assumption? That wasn't a rhetorical question. Who'd like to share? Oh, thank you.
Andrew Scott from Connecting the Dots. My example goes back many years when three of us as young students were looking to rent a house together, and they asked what we did for work, and we said we were actuaries, and they came back to us with so how do you expect to afford the rent? And it wasn't afterwards that it occurred to us that they thought we said we were actors.
Other examples, Gloria.
Hello, from Deloitte. So this was when I was working overseas for a Japanese client. So I was the signing actuary for that particular client. First time meeting the client face-to-face in a boardroom. I had my team there with me, so my team were white males. The client walked in after we were there in the meeting room first, walked straight past me, shook the hands of everybody except for mine, assuming that I, being the one of two females there, was going to be just the secretary. So he had his PA there, who was actually the secretary, taking notes, and then there was me, and as a signing actuary, and he completely ignored me. And I guess it's only after the meeting has started and I was the one making all the calls, making the decisions and things like that, that was when, at the end of the meeting, when we walked out, he actually shook my hand to say goodbye.
Jess, have you got one?
Question.
Okay. About assumptions? Eric, we might come back to the question, but we'll just take one more example of unfair assumptions and we'll get Leslie to comment. Let's got another one. Come on, Gloria. We won't have it. Oh, we've got one. Thank you. Last one.
Thanks. My one is about, I work flexible hours, and I work 2 half-days from home each week. And I often get phone calls while I'm working during those hours, and people say, "Oh, are you at home? Oh, I'm really sorry you're at home. I'll call you another time." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm working from home." "Oh, yeah, I'll call you tomorrow when you're in the office." And I say, "But I'm working. But oh, have you got your kids there?" "No, I don't have my children here when I'm working from home." And that's what I find a lot. Yeah. People presume that I'm working from home because I'm spending more time with my children and that they're actually present while I'm there, which I find really strange, and it sort of devalues that opportunity for flexible work if people think you're not really doing anything. So, yeah, so very strange.
Thank you. So the exercise is partly a bit of fun and partly illuminating. So Leslie, this thing about unfair assumptions, what's the core point?
I think one of the core points here is to take these assumptions and have the courage to have a conversation and call somebody out on it. Come back to the question about how can we affect change. That's how we can affect change. Come back to my first example in my talk about my friend who had the courage to say to her bosses, "Why have you made this decision?" It was uncomfortable conversations, but she had it. And we're not going to get rid of assumptions and make change unless we call people out on things.
Thank you. We have another question from the webinar audience. This is from Eric Ranson. Leslie, you mentioned quotas and the benefits of diversity. So how do you determine sensible quotas in areas where there is limited diversity already? Do we care about quotas / diversity in lower paid roles as well as in the focus on, say, board roles, for example? Nursing might be an area to consider for both questions.
Yeah, I think in terms of diversity for lower level roles, as the questioner sort of put it, and nursing is actually quite a good example where, generally speaking, the male-female gender is the other way around to often is seen in corporate environments. I think one of the things is having roles open to all and encouraging the applications from all to have that. Quotas, I've never been too sure about whether quotas are actually work or not. I think it depends on the organisation and how that is actually enacted within that organisation as to whether it works. So I think the jury's a little bit out on the quotas, but at least by having a quota, it encourages people to think more broadly about who they actually put forward for different roles and who applies. And it's encouraging more people to apply. I think one of the other things I mentioned earlier on was often people don't apply because they don't think they get a chance. If there's a quota system, then they know they're going to get a chance, and that encourages more people to apply, and that's a good thing.
I've had an additional contribution from Trang on the assumptions question, and she said here are a couple of common assumptions, especially those that might apply to part-timers, especially female part-timers. So one is, this project is going to be so busy so a part-timer cannot lead it. And the second, Friday work events are best for all because that is when people want to wind down. You want to comment on those before I get to Chang's comment?
Yeah, I think the social events one is actually quite an interesting one. Firms I've been aware of have thought that's a really good idea that, you know, a golf day is the only way to days with clients. I mean, apart from the fact that it's a lot of dudes who don't play golf either, but, or they arrange something at, you know, for an important meeting at 8:30 in the morning when you're doing the school run. So it's thinking about those things as well. It's catering for all. And it's, you know, childcare obviously is not just the preserve of ladies. It's a lot of fathers now want to have a really full participation in their child's upbringing as well.
Chang's additional comment then in terms of those is that part-timers should be given the choice or work restructured to support them if they are passionate about taking on the project. And she also thinks the team events should be moved around every now and then to cater for different people's availability. So yep. Sounds reasonable. We have to go back to broader topics to explore. Questions, comments, observations. Roland, was that a wave?
Yeah. Yes. Hi, Ronald from SCORE. Just on that quota system suggestion, I just wonder, would that actually open up a reverse discrimination? You know, people who... You're discriminating people who are actually capable by setting a quota on, you know, not letting, you know, for example, enough Asians to be actuaries.
I think the key point there is if there is a quota system, it opens up more people to be considered. And the diversity of the candidate pool then is broadened, and then people are assessed on their merits.
So encouraging people to... Yeah. Did I see your hand, Louise?
Just wondering, with recruitment these days, are there any themes of new skills or different skills that are coming through for hiring of actuaries or part qualified?
Sure. Yeah. A lot of organisations now are moving towards a greater emphasis on data analytics, but a lot of the technological skills are being a good example. SQL, if people haven't already got it, would be the sort of direction to go in if people want to take advantage of those data analytics roles going forward, which I think we're going to see more of. There's absolutely no reason why actuaries, if they want to, can't transition into more data analytics, less strictly actuarial roles. But it does need looking at the technology and looking at learning different technologies which might not have been taught at uni.
Next question. We have one from Amy.
You talked about looking at people from outside different fields to fill positions. From the reverse side, if we were looking from moving from traditional fields into other fields, what techniques would you recommend that to start the search into those other fields, to, like, if we can solve the business problem, but understanding what those areas are that we could fit into well?
Yeah, I think that the first one would be, first of all, having a passion for what it is that you've highlighted that you want to do, and then breaking down that role into the specific skill sets that are needed, and then look at how your skill sets are transferable into that particular role. To come back to the example of the I was chatting to yesterday, who went into property price thing. She used her, I think she was commercial lines pricing with a GI insurer. She used that experience and translated it into, and overlaid it into a new type of industry and a new thing. Just about looking at different ways that things can be done. The control cycle can be adapted to a million and one sort of different things. It's just having that thought about, right, well, what do I do? What do I want to do? What is it about what I do that means that I can do that over there? And then working out ways to be able to articulate that, getting that clear in your mind, and then being in a position to put yourself in front of the right people who will hear that message effectively to enable you to put that into practice.
Next question. Kind of a follow-up from that. So the question about if you're thinking about moving in different territories, thinking about different types of roles, in this day and age, in your opinion, what role does social media play? In particular, what are the pluses and minuses of your of LinkedIn, you know, at a basic level? Is there any value in being on LinkedIn? And if so, how might you use that if you're looking for a broader career path?
I think putting yourself out there, as it were, is something that's really, really important. And you know, on your LinkedIn profile where it says name and then pricing actuary, so rather than say pricing actuary, why not say something different that really describes what it is that you do or what you want to do? I've seen some really good ones, and having a really strong LinkedIn profile that orientates you towards where your passions are and what you've been done is really important. Because it's not just sort of recruiters like myself, but also increasingly these days, employers themselves will use LinkedIn to be able to find the sort of skill set that they want to do. And the way that that search engine works on there is that you put in a particular skill or a particular attribute that will bring up the names. So unless you've got that in your profile, you're not going to come up on a search for somebody which could be the sort of role that you're looking for, that you're trying to highlight yourself for. So it's very much about putting yourself out there. And LinkedIn is an increasingly powerful tool to be able to do that. But you do have to get your profile up.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm normal, but and my children think I'm a stalker. But if I'm having a meeting with someone for the first time, I'd do a bit of a search, but I'd certainly have a look at their LinkedIn profile. Just give me a few clues about their background, a few clues about their style, a few clues about who's already in their network.
And coming back to one of the other points I was making about if you highlight maybe an organisation you want to work for or a type of industry that you want to move into, you can use LinkedIn to find somebody that you know that knows that person that you want to be introduced to. So it's a more gentle way of getting in front of the person that you want to speak to.
Yeah, so that's a good example, isn't it? Where if you're taking your advice earlier about finding people to talk to, you're in the areas you might be interested in. If you don't have a network there, someone you know may know someone there. Cool. Other areas you'd like to explore? We haven't really touched on any of the broader observations on leadership, the sense of inspiring. Do you have to be Nelson Mandela to get a following? Thank you.
Daniel Stone from TEL. Something I was thinking about, I mentioned to Michelle and she prompted me now, so blame her, is there a likelihood that somebody who's more extroverted to head towards leadership roles versus somebody who's introverted? Because I guess at that leadership level, typically it's about creating a vision and making people want to follow you. And it normally involves expressing, I guess, your vision. So how do you recommend for people who are on the lower side of the introverted spectrum to make that jump and try and take that leadership role in spite of the introversion?
Good question, Daniel. You can go first. I've got a comment on that one.
Okay. The example that I used of my friend, that is, she is not a person who's, you know, sort of particularly sort of extrovert and out there and all that sort of thing. It's about small steps, if you like, by demonstrating leadership to your immediate circle of friends, work colleagues there, by leading teams, leading others, and to quietly get into a position where you are having communication, having conversations with people sort of further up the ladder within the organisation as well. Because leadership isn't about the big story at all. It's about the way that you conduct yourself and the way that you live, values and the way that you inspire others. It doesn't have to be loud at all. So your advice would be to continue to show others a pathway, if you like, by the way that you are, leading your own team or advising others or moving into committees. If you
join various committees and things that helped you to, sort of, if you like, get more confident about what you're trying to say and what contribution that you want to be able to give to different people.
Daniel, another set.
I guess I'm just actually wondering, you mentioned that being an introvert, you can be a leader. I would like to explore that more, maybe explain what kind of leader that person might be. I do think extroverts are more naturally able to fulfill that role, so convince me otherwise.
Daniel, let me validate your view that certainly my experience is that there is a natural bias towards extroverts rather than introverts in terms of senior roles. So turn the other way, I think that introverts have to work harder, but they certainly can be successful. I had a conversation with my sister recently on this. There is, anybody who has seen the TED Talk on the importance of introverts? I can't remember the exact title, but that's what it is. Okay, so it's a really good reminder, A, about the bias against introverts, and secondly, about the power. I think it's called the power of introverts, isn't it? And so my sister, even though she's not really an introvert, any time to demonstrate that she at least is aware of different behaviours, she sends the link to people who might have an inherent bias about introverts versus extroverts. So it's part of her way of educating the world. But it's also a good reminder to people, and I found it quite helpful myself. So thinking from one example of a leader who I totally respect in the work I was doing with him on a leadership program, a fellow named John Ballard, who was the CEO at was a division of Coca-Cola and Matul, then he was on the board at Woolworths, a guy called John Ballard. He described himself as a social introvert, but his actual style in terms of where he gets his energy, you know, in the corner, he'd prepare for things, he'd study, he'd be on top of things, so he wouldn't be feeling like he was put on the spot in meetings or wouldn't be expected to go off the top of his head. He would know his stuff and be able to perform to the expectations of a leader, even though he was a true introvert. So it can be done, and I'm sure they mentioned some in the TED Talk. There's some, they give some examples of introverts that, you know, but I think you do have to work harder. Have a look at the TED Talk if you haven't, use the power of an introvert to advantage. Sorry, that's my homily.
That's fine.
Other questions? Comments. We've got five spare minutes. For people on the webinar, we reached our target of three. If you'd like to break the record, we're happy to take one more question or comment. Well, here's someone who has literally had thousands of conversations with actuaries as candidates and as clients, as recruiters, as people looking to fill roles. What would you just love to hear from someone without much experience? You can have mine.
Jess from the NDIA. From a recruitment perspective, I feel like we've done a good job of attracting sort of more experienced actuaries who have looking for that diversity in their career. What advice would you have for us in attracting graduates and sort of younger actuaries to come and join something that's not very traditional and that's probably not a not as well known?
Do you have like a marketing pack about you?
We have a marketing pack about the NDIA, but I think our team is quite unique in it, and it's going to grow a lot over the next couple of years, and I don't think we've really targeted that.
No. But you have people at the moment who are sort of graduates and in their early careers already with you?
Yeah. Limited.
Yeah. So maybe speak to them about what is it attracted them to NDIA, and then put together some documentation around, which is like a marketing document. Because a marketing document for a role is not just about the organisation and how funky it is, it's about what it can give that person, the what's in it for me. Why would they want to come and join you? What would their career look like? What development and training will you give them? How can they use their actuarial skill set in what they perceive as a slightly different environment? So think about those things and chat to your people that you already have at that level to ask them why they joined, because the reasons might be new and different. And then put together something that you'll be able to show to people who are a little bit interested. And it will also give you some guidance, coming back to how you write your advert,
how you go about attracting people, because then you're speaking to what the people that are your target audience are likely to want.
Peter.
This is a bit of a general question, but what's the one skill or attribute that you would find your traditional actuary lacking when employers are looking to fill a role or solve a business problem, and potentially in the non-traditional actuarial space as well?
It's obviously difficult to generalise. But if I think about conversations I've had with clients who say, we really like a candidate who's got more of X, then I think the X would be commerciality. Communication skills come up, and that's not just about being able to have a nice chat. It's about being able to develop relationships. And I think this alludes a little bit to what I was saying earlier about putting yourself out there to get a role for yourself. Is also very good and very important in the workplace, is being able to network within an organisation as well. So it's that communication, that ability, again, having conversations, going out there and talking to people. So it'd be the commerciality and the communication.
Last chance. We've got time for one more question. Something you always wanted to know about careers, career paths. Going once, going twice. Okay. Well, please join me in thanking Leslie for sharing her wisdom and experience today. So if I can just provide one wrap-up, and in doing so, a reminder that if you do have 5, 10 spare minutes and want to have a chat, Leslie's going to remain behind, or if we've found the conversation about assumptions, feel free to have a chat with the person you said hello to earlier. So some of you are probably wondering about the topic for today. Where did the title Leading the Horse to Water come from, and what has that got to do with what we've just spoken about? So my view is this water around diversity in your career path, diversity in your organisation, that through her many years of experience, Leslie has in some ways led us to the water today. She's provided some clues to you about how you might embark on a more diverse career. She's provided some clues to you about how your organisation might have a wider spectrum of skills and backgrounds in your workforce. But it's also clear, as per the saying, that having led you to the water, she can't make you drink it. But I'm hoping that she has inspired you to do so. Best wishes in your organisation, best wishes in your career paths.